Traveling the Vortex.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Glenn.
Thanks for joining us this time. This week, we don't have much news, but let's go ahead and get ahead our contact information out there first off.
Absolutely. If you want to send us feedback, go ahead and send us feedback at travelingthevortex@gmail.com. You can also contact us on the blog by going to travelingthevortex.blogspot.com. You can leave comments and feedback on there. We also have our Twitter, which is travelvortex. And if you want to contact us on Facebook, that's Traveling the Vortex. Just search on Facebook for that.
And if all else fails, try smoke signals.
Or write into a black box of a futuristic ship.
Ah, yeah, that's... I forgot where you were at. That's
very clever. This past week, or last episode, we asked you if I should go back and watch Blink, Silence in the Library, and Forest of the Dead before continuing on with In the Time of the Angels.
Time of the Angels.
Time of the Angels. And...
Flesh and Stone.
Flesh and Stone. And the response we got was, you need to go back and watch everything else.
Overwhelmingly.
So, I did. And let's start off with, I watched them literally in order, Blink, and then down the line of air dates. So let's start off with Blink. Really, really well done episode. It was, at points it was creepy, like it should be.
Just real quick, I suppose we should throw out spoiler alert for those of you that haven't seen these episodes. You know, we didn't do that last week and I felt bad about it. But
if you haven't seen Blink by now, though.
Yeah, you need to.
Well, I haven't.
Stop what you're doing and go watch Blink and then come back to us because it was that good. But I digress.
I really enjoyed it. I thought the main actress did a really good job. They did a good job leaving you in the dark when you needed to be in the dark, and then explaining things when you needed to know. My only real comments on it that I would have liked to see is, I think it would have been neat after the fact to show how the Doctor lost the TARDIS. And I really hope when I go back and rewatch everything, at some point I hear them mention having to go fight whatever they had to go fight at the very end of the episode. That way it could kind of fit in somewhere. But overall, I really liked it. The angel idea was really clever. The fact that their greatest defense mechanism is also their weakest, and how they got away from the angels, I thought was really well done.
I think this is a testament to Stephen Moffat's writing, because he actually wrote this one. And this was another one of those ones, and you noticed in A Christmas Carol, where he uses the, you know, kind of time as the element of the story. Time is as much a character in this story as anything else. And the idea of time, you know, kind of going back and changing things and staying within the continuity of the timeline. I think he does a really good job of writing to that kind of thing. And I thought that was handled really well. And this is the first time that you really see Stephen take that, you know, approach to the linearness of time and time travel and use that as part of the story. And I like that a lot. And interestingly enough, this being such a Doctor light episode, I mean, obviously the Doctor's very, very, very rarely in it. Martha's in it even less. And you bring to the forefront, you know, Sally Sparrow and all the characters that she interacts with, and I thought everybody did a fantastic job. And this by far, and I've said it before, is my favorite new series. We'll talk about your blog post earlier, but the new series episode of all time. And when I saw this, I was just blown away by it. Blink's probably the one I've revisited the most and watched the most because it's so good. And I'm like you. I like the creepiness of it. I think it was it's a behind the sofa episode. It's
totally.
You know, you're totally enthralled by these angels that, you know, for all intents and purposes are just statues to anybody else. But then, you know, as soon as you close your eyes, or as soon as it's dark or something like that, you know, or just even blink, there's movement. And I like the concept and the idea of how this, you know, transcendental being works, and that as long as they're being seen, they can't move. And as long as they're not seen, they can. And that just, it added to the creepiness and the creepy element to it all.
I agree. This was, I'm not a horror fan. Keith is. And we talked a little bit about that, you know, for Keith, there were some tense moments.
It was a very tense episode in general. And that's what I liked about it. I didn't find it scary. Parts were a little creepy, but overall, you could just feel the intensity in it.
I was scared. I'm not going to lie. This really harkened back to old school Doctor Who's as a kid that you would watch. And it didn't matter that the monster was made out of green trash bags. It was a monster, and it was in the pit, and it was coming for you, and it was coming for the Doctor. And you watched from behind the couch. There was that kind of, it really gave that feel to it. I thought it was exceptionally well done. I liked the time travel folding in on itself and how all of those elements came to a head. And amazingly, there are no loose ends. It's a very, very tightly written episode where, for all of the stuff that was going on, it made sense. They had the opportunity to, you know, there could have been any one of those elements that could have been dropped and would have unraveled it, and it didn't happen. The angels themselves are just, you know, they were terrifying, the concept. And the great hook at the end with all of the shots of the gargoyles and the statues, mm-hmm. and just maybe, maybe not. It was unsettling. I really, really liked it. I can't say it. And I agree with you. This is probably definitely among my favorites. And we've talked about a little bit about this, that another friend of ours, Julian, who was kind of interested in Doctor Who, we thought, well, we want to get him in the show. He's got to watch Blink because that's so good. And you kind of warned me it's a Doctor Light episode, which I hadn't really thought of at the time. Maybe just because I was so enthralled with how it all was put together. The Doctor's not in it very much. And I'm curious to know how you... I mean, this was really... I mean, you're some experience with David Tennant, but...
A little bit, but not
you,
much.
You didn't get much more with this one.
Yeah,
but.
And so I really didn't get to form an opinion on David Tennant as the Doctor until Silence in the Library. Which, mentioning that, let's move on to the...
Well, just one thing I wanted to say about Blink before we move on. Is, and you talked about introducing Julian to Doctor Who by introducing Blink, and I've always contested the fact that I don't think Blink is the episode that you introduce a new person to Doctor Who.
I did
and
kind of leave that off tonight.
my reason for that is Blink is such a great episode that it sets the bar so high for the series. Now, I enjoy the entire series, and I'm a Doctor Who fan through and through, but if you come to this series and you watch Blink for the first time, and you expect that type of episode every time that you watch Doctor Who, you're going to be sorely disappointed, because Doctor Who, even though storytelling is always very good, there's elements of it that I think you kind of have to gradually work into. And I think if you go into Blink as a new watcher and you watch it and you say, wow, what a great episode, I'm going to start going back and watch Doctor Who, they've set the bar so high with this episode that I'm afraid that a new viewer might... maybe even get a little bit of a sour taste from other episodes that aren't necessarily, you know, it might be as grand, but the storytelling isn't the same type of storytelling. And that's why I've always been afraid of introducing people to Doctor Who. I think you work them in with a few episodes that are good, they give you a good dose of the Doctor, give you a good dose of the feel of the show, and then you say, oh, here, by the way, watch this one. And then
which is what we did wind up doing with Julian. We started actually him off with Girl in the Fireplace.
Another excellent. And
another
Stephen Moffat. Yeah, so another excellent.
Well, all the episodes we'll be talking about tonight were written by Stephen Moffat.
Which I didn't realize until going back through the liner notes. And then it made total sense because he created River Song and everything. But Stephen, we love you. We can't get enough of you.
He is, I have to admit, so far... brilliant.
I'm trying to think if there was something about... There was a question that I had about Blink for you specifically, and now it's escaped me. And I guess if it comes back to me, it'll come back. But let's go to Silence in the Library.
Well, I'm going to kind of talk about the both episodes together, because in my mind, I watched them back-to-back, so...
It's a two-parter. You're allowed.
It's one big episode. I thought the stuff with River was really interesting. I want to get into that in a little bit. I thought the idea of the library was really cool. This just planet devoted to being a library. That I'm a book lover, so that's just awesome to me. And then the fact that it goes into lockdown and saves everybody to the hard drive of the giant computer, and then that the giant computer ends up being the guy's grandmother, great-grandmother,
something like
great-aunt that. Great-aunt or something yeah. like that.
Some distant relation.
Yeah, which I thought was really clever. I thought the in theory, the idea of the shadows and being afraid of the dark was neat until they started to explain it a little bit too much, that there were these microscopic things that would just devour the flesh.
Sort of demystifies it, I believe.
Yeah, it made it kind of
which
like,
I'm still fine with, because I think then it introduces the science element, because that one thing that I've always liked about Doctor Who is the fact that Doctor Who, even though it's science fantasy, it's still science based. They for the most part, with the exception of some few instances, they still stay in the world of reality. They still ground it. There's no mysticism. There's no magic. There's no anytime there's mysticism or magic, it's able to be explained away. And I like that because it keeps religion out of Doctor Who, which I think is important. But I think I certainly see your point of view in the sense that, you know, stay out of the dark. It's creepy. You know, there's this mystic element here.
I can accept supernatural things.
But then when they start introducing the whole microbes, and it grounded it more, and I think it was appropriate, and certainly didn't spoil anything for me. But it I can see where it could have taken some.
I think they just could have done more with it. And then the fact that it got into the body, the suits, and we're walking around in the suits. I know they needed to have some sort of physical thing so people would be like afraid of it. But just kind of, I don't know. And I thought the whole dream points of the story, especially once the companion goes, her name's escaping me.
Donna
goes into that dreamscape. I found that really well done of how they did it. Of wait, we just said we were going to go do this, and now we are. And her kind of being confused, and then them talking to her, and she remembers.
Well, now her time is jumping around, and it's almost like it's just there on the edge of her mind that it's happening, but she doesn't really recognize it, especially at first, that, you know, at one point she's talking to her husband in one room, and the next point she's putting the kids to bed and telling them a bedtime story. And it's linear in the fact that it's happening as it would in like a television show or something where you, okay, cut scene, we go to the next thing.
Yeah.
But that's what's really happening to her, and she doesn't quite grasp that until later on.
And then the explanation of how they showed that it was a computer and all the kids are the same, I thought that was really well done.
Well done. I think it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, first thing, I'm going to attack this as one episode because it really just one large episode. But I think one of the things I noticed is the style in the episodes changes to a point. Because in the first episode, we've got everybody in the library. First, we've got Donna and the doctor. And then we've got these strangers that show up, and they're there to investigate, you know, what's going on. People in the library, you know, it just, that had sort of a certain story element to it. And then when we turn around and we come back for the next episode, now we're getting the people in the library, but we're also getting Donna's storyline. So it almost has a different feel to it because we're bouncing back and forth there. And I like the contrast between the two because the first is this creepy, what is this element? What, you know, stay out of the dark. What's chasing us? What, you know, we've got to figure out what's going on here. We introduce these new characters. The second element is once we've explained that this is what's going on, now we've got to figure out what this conundrum is in the computer. What is this world that's being established by this little girl? Why are we seeing into, you know, her mind and her life and what's going on there? And I thought that was a neat contrast between the two episodes. It really made them feel like two different stories, but still all part of one story arc, and I really enjoyed that.
Now, I'm going to feign a little bit of ignorance because it's been a while since I've gone back. I did not do my homework this week and go back and rewatch the episodes. So it's been a little bit of time have passed since the last time I'd seen them. I agree with you. Just the idea of don't go in the shadows. It's not even the dark, because I mean we're all afraid of the dark. That's one of the things that that you know is primal. You know, human nature: stay out of the dark, and don't even go in the shadows. Okay, I'm terrified at this point. You've really tapped into something here that is. Ooh, yeah. All right, I'm with you. I'm behind the couch again, and I'm with you guys. When they started to explain it, I liked it from the sci-fi fan in me. I felt it really kind of demystified them just a little bit as far as the beings go. Now, I still thought the effect of the walking skeleton inside the spaceship, that was, it was very Scooby-Doo. My favorite episode of Scooby-Doo is the one where they're investigating the old abandoned airfield, and there's the space helmet guy with the glowing skeleton head that and he would run around like that. I don't know why. It's just, as a kid, that memory. And when I saw that guy with the skeleton head inside that plastic visor spacesuit, I just went, oh, because it just pulled that right out of me. In the second part of the episode, where they start to kind of open the things up, because the first one's very claustrophobic. I mean, yeah. It's a whole planet, but we're in a couple of rooms.
Right. Because we're forced to be the light is, and we've got this light coming in from the
We're a couple different rooms. And then they start cutting down to these little shafts of light and getting smaller and smaller and smaller and more of this encroaching darkness. It was just a really cool idea. When they switched over and we started kind of opening things back up, did they explain it in the second part of the episode, or was it in the first that they went to the microbe explanation?
It was in the first.
It was still in
we
the first?
We got it towards the end of the first episode, yeah.
So even that kind of starts the transition over, that we're now getting more into the computer and the scientific explanation in the second half of things. But, I agree with you. I thought it was really well done. Let's talk about River.
River really intrigues me. The fact that she's from the doctor's future, not just the future, the doctor's future, and when she meets him here, he doesn't know her yet. And the fact that she has his screwdriver, and the fact that he put together, oh, that's why I gave her my screwdriver the last time I saw her, was so that I could upload her into the computer, because I knew she was going to die this episode. I did not expect to see her death. And that was really interesting, the fact that we're seeing this relationship of whatever it is reverse, where he's meeting her for the first time. She has known him for a long time and ends up dying in this episode. Yeah. And eventually their times will cross properly, but I found that really interesting.
I thought I was going to refrain from talking about this because we get a few more River Song episodes clearly in season 5. We're going to get more River Song episodes in season 6. That's clear from the trailers. But I was hesitant to talk about this because I wanted you to see more River Song. But I think it's safe to say, because I think you're going along the parallel line the same that I am, that it's interesting to see, and this is just my theory, is I think that we're seeing two timelines going completely in reverse. We've got the Doctor progressing one direction and River progressing the other direction. Every time that she meets the Doctor, it's going back in his timeline, and every time he meets River, it's moving forward in his timeline and backwards in her timeline. And I think it's interesting that we're going to get a cross parallel at some point where we're going to get the exact middle of the road, and then we're going to reverse because, perhaps we won't reverse because now we know those events. So it's interesting that, and they kind of allude to the fact that something happened, and that's why she came back. And it's almost like they're setting up the impression that she dies at the beginning of their meeting, and perhaps, I think what they're alluding to, and I don't know that they would go this far, but perhaps he's dying. Right. At the beginning of her timeline. So I think
when
that
she first meets
right. Him. And so I think it's an interesting in theory, and I'm just really hopeful it'll play out and we'll get a little more about River Song, which I think Stephen Moffat has alluded to in interviews that we're going to learn some origins of River Song within this next
season. And is there anybody but Stephen Moffat, again, that could have pulled off that kind of concept? Yeah. I mean, if there's anybody in the Doctor Who universe, the Doctor is ripe for crossing it up and coming back on himself and doing all that kind of stuff. And for Stephen to take that idea and go one step further with it, and now we've brought in an outside character that's going to be coming back into it. So I just thought that was really cool when she meets him and says, oh, well, but you're my doctor, but you're not my doctor. Not
right.
yet.
This is the youngest I've seen you.
That reaction on his face was like, what?
Well, it's an interesting thing, too, because I've gone back and watched these two episodes now since I've watched Matt Smith and seen the River Song episodes. And it sort of astounded me because I watched the season 4 episodes with River Song, back in the day. And then Matt Smith comes along and he's actually a younger looking doctor. And I thought, oh, there's some continuity error, because she said, this is the youngest I've ever seen you. And in my mind, she looked upon his face and said, oh, you're so young. Well, she does say that in a sense. She says, oh, you're so young.
But she looks into his eyes.
Right. But this is the interesting thing, is because then Matt Smith looks younger. I thought there was a continuity problem. But when you go back and watch this episode, it is. She looks into his eyes and says, this is the longest. She even says something about,
in your eyes,
yeah,
I see a youth, or something like that. Yeah,
exactly. And so I thought it was it actually still works. And I thought that was amazing that when you go back and you watch this, it still works on the present level, that they've you know, expanded her character so much, but they haven't deviated from the fact that this is her final point in her timeline, in her life. And it's really worked really well. And this episode, again, like Plink, clearly shows that Stephen Moffat knows how to use time in order to, as a character. And this storyline, he's very, I think he, better than almost any writer in Doctor Who, understands time, or understands how to use time to work in an episode. And he's done a fantastic job.
It almost makes me wonder, now, if I'm not mistaken, that the time these would have been written, the announcement had already been made that David Tennant was going to be leaving.
That I don't believe is true, because think we knew that David Tennant was leaving until the end of season 4. And this is sandwiched kind of towards...
It's near the end.
It's near the end.
It's about the 8th and 9th episode.
Okay, so, well, but, yeah, I guess so. Out of 13, it just makes out me of 13 wonder episodes, that's if, probably true. Yeah.
Because Stephen Moffat has always said that the intent was to cast an older doctor and kind of go more into that, because not that he would come out and say that, well, David Tennant was too young, but just that they wanted to kind of move away direction.
Well, we've had Eccleston, who was younger. We had, you know, somewhat younger. We had Tennant, who was even younger still. And, yeah, mm-hmm. I think the idea at one time was to look for a doctor that was a slight bit older, change the dynamic of a companion and a doctor that, at least in look and stature, and obviously he's 900 some years old, but you know, just in the way he acts as being young, I think they were going to try to get away from that dynamic, do more of a father-daughter relationship type thing that they did with doctors in the past. Hartnell, obviously,
yeah,
you know, is the prime example. But yeah, I don't know. It just makes me wonder if that line was written. Well,
if he knew in advance that this was coming, and he put that line in there knowing that he was going to start looking at an older doctor, and then Matt Smith obviously comes along and blows his mind.
Right.
But we're fortunate that because it was the eyes comment, that we still got away. Yeah, still got away with it.
Absolutely.
Alex Kingston. You know, she was great on ER. Which is, I think, where most people.
The only thing I'd ever seen her before. I think she played Alex on ER. Yeah.
Phenomenal, that the energy that she brought, and you know, it doesn't hurt that she's smoking hot.
She's a very attractive woman, and she's very flirty, and she's very, you know, her boisterous character. I love that.
Oh, the interactions between her and the doctor were so much fun to watch, especially earlier on where he doesn't know who she is, and she knows who he is. And
well, I think it even gets better in Series 5.
Well, yeah, because I agree.
She's even more so, you know, toying with this, you know, hey, sweetie, what's this relationship and whatnot.
And
so
it was fun, too, because Donna picked up on it. And even though the whole thing with, you know, Donna's whole relationship with the doctor is we're not together.
Plutonic, yeah.
And it was over and over and over again that it was funny because everybody thought they were, because they argued like an old married couple.
Yes.
But then even for her to pick up on it, and she teased him about it, I thought was cool. But what did you think of David Tennant? Now that you actually kind of got a couple under your belt
I really enjoyed watching David as the doctor. I see a lot of similarities between the two. I can completely picture them as one character in different bodies. I mean, a lot of their mannerisms are very similar, but still unique. And he still had the same energy that I like from Matt Smith that Tennant had in his talking, but it might have been more the situation, but he seemed much more serious than Matt Smith.
You agree with that?
I think maybe because I've seen more Tennant, more Matt Smith, I disagree. I think they're very different doctors. I think just maybe their enthusiasm and their...
The way they talk about and think things.
Yeah, I think that's similar. But beyond that, I think Matt Smith's taken such a different turn with that. You know,
Once I watch more, I may.
Yeah,
it definitely felt like I was watching the same character, just in a different form.
A lot of that, I think, comes through maybe it's the youthfulness, maybe it's the youthful excitement to him. It, with older series doctors, you very much get a sense of been there, done that. I mean, he has traveled the universe. He knows everything. Or he's completely in the dark and doesn't know anything about the situation he's been dumped into. And he's going to figure it out. That's kind of the Sherlock Holmes aspect of the character. With both of these guys, and to a lesser extent Eccleston, both of them just exude this boundless, I don't care what it is, this is really cool.
Well, they're both,
they're really into the moment.
They're both clearly excited, whether it's something good happening or something scary or something bad happening, they still show the same enthusiasm.
They're just glad to
what's
be there.
Happening. Yeah.
Yeah,
I think that does carry over between the two doctors. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's something I've really enjoyed about them, is the just, you know, when they sit down and fiddle with a piece of technology that's clearly alien, the doctor gets into that. But these guys take it one step further. They really, it doesn't matter. Like you said, it could be something horrific. Oh, it's, you know, vat of acid eating everybody up. Look at that. How interesting is that? Look at the, you know, and they just go off on it. And that to me is one of the things that I really have enjoyed about both of these actors, is that they just take that with it.
Let's move on into the season five episodes that we got, which
season five episodes really intrigue me.
Time of Angels and Flesh and Stone. So now this is we went back and said, okay, Science of the Library and Forest of the Dead. Was that the other one?
Yeah,
I think so.
Okay. You had mentioned that those were one big story, and I kind of said, well, there's kind of a separation there.
I
didn't have that feeling with Time of Angels and Flesh and Stone. This really, to me, felt like one big episode.
Yeah, there was no tonal change at all in this episode. There are a lot of elements that got me really excited to watch more. Some of the non-procedural elements, the serial elements, like the whole crack issue, and the fact that the doctor brings up again that Amy didn't remember the Daleks, and the reason why River was in prison, and who did she actually kill. As far as the major story part of this, I thought this was really clever, a nice way to bring back the angels in a different way to tell the story.
They sort of evolved, too.
Yeah, they
did. Because you've got these certain type of angels in Blink, and then when they come back, they've kind of gotten this different approach to the Weeping Angels, which I liked. I thought it was good to kind of broaden the scope, because I mean, what do you do with these inanimate statues that can only move when it's dark? They still stayed with that element, but we got a little bit broader with it.
We actually got to see them move,
which was really cool
and really well animated.
First time I saw it, I wasn't quite sure, because you're just not supposed to see them move. But on second viewing, the way they did it was really, really well done and clever. And something I liked about early on when they started showing them and moving in different positions is we got a lot of that quick black, you know, and we just, you know, we could see the progression of them. To actually see them move when we saw them move, at that point, almost was a little more creepier than seeing them moving and being in different positions each time the lights flashed on. So, again, on second viewing, it took me two times, because it was wrong to see it the first time. The second time, I was like, that's almost eerier to be able to see them move now. And I thought that was interesting.
I see, maybe that's my problem, is because, I'll be honest, I was not as big a fan. I still liked the episodes. I still thought they were really good. But I felt they, in a way, almost bastardized the angels as a concept. And maybe it's because I like Blink so well. Maybe it's just because it just felt a little different and wrong that they changed the character. You mentioned Evolve, and like I said, maybe I just need to go back and rewatch it a second time. But it seemed to me that, you know, as scary and terrifying to me as they were in the first episode, they don't really kill anybody. You just wind up back in time. They suck your life force off, and these are bloodthirsty creatures of the night. That I mean, they're very almost vampiric, where they're coming after you, and we're going to kill you, and we're going to eat you, and they're very happy about it. I mean, they're just going to have done with it.
Which I think they glossed over. I didn't think they quite explained that well enough. That why suddenly this big dynamic
changed. that bothered me about the episode.
Well, I could see that.
Looking back at the episodes, I could see they're killing more necessary because they're trying to save all their brethren, and these people are going to interfere with that once they figure it out. And they don't need to send you back in time to feed off your life force because there's the giant ship giving them energy. So I can see why they kind of changed it a little bit. And as far as the movements, it worked really well for me, especially because her eyes were closed, and so it just took them a second to realize that she
You now, as the audience or the viewer, are no longer seeing them and causing them not to move. Now you're outside of that. Right. There's no one to see them move, and so you finally get to. And I think that's why I accepted it the second time as well. But I see where you're coming from on the sort of demystifying them. There's a dynamic change in the reason for being. You know, in Blink, they're sending them back in time to live. But I also agree with Keith's assumption that now they've got this source. The ship obviously was what was, you know, bringing them back. And
there are definite elements that I liked. I liked the angel coming out of the TV set Amy, yeah. And then trying to get into the door, which I thought was great. And you mentioned that there's no religion, or at least hasn't been brought into it.
No,
but
we did have this
military
church. The church becomes a military in the 51st century.
Which I thought was actually kind of a cool idea.
Now, and don't get me wrong. When I say there's no religion in Doctor Who, I guess what I'm saying is there's no mystifying. There's none of that, you know, miracles and suspend belief. Whereas they did, interestingly enough, take that approach that in the, what was it, 51st century, mm-hmm. suddenly the military is the church, or the church is the military. I liked that dynamic. I liked looking at that and saying, hey, this is something that might have come about by, you know, whatever year this is. And that was interesting. I did like that.
Well, and I liked the line it was just a throwaway line that he says. It's like, well, the church can only go so far, and then it's got to become something else.
That's right.
And so it became an army.
And I think they touched on that.
It kind of gives Onward Christian Soldiers a whole new meaning.
absolutely.
I also, one of the greatest, and again, going back to Stephen Moffat, because he comes up with these little gems of dialogue. The parking brake.
Oh, yeah, the fact that she was able to fly the TARDIS.
Yeah, that's intriguing.
Was very interesting. That's intriguing. And the fact that she says something about, well, you weren't there that day. And I'm like, is she joking or is she serious?
Yeah.
Was it not really the doctor?
Yeah.
I just hearing
Matt Smith do the, you know that sound.
They'll hear us. What do you mean they'll hear us? You know the, and he's arm movement and everything getting into it. She goes, you know, you're doing it wrong. It's the parking brake's on. And then she lands the ship. And I died. Because he's taken something that is quintessential to the show. And this is something that kind of carried over, I think, in a way from what Russell T. Davies did. Russell T. Davies, for me, did a lot of really nifty things, establishing that the opening to the show is the Time Vortex. It's not just a cool opening. It's an actual part of the show. And then taking one step further, which you haven't seen yet with the drums.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This sound, the music at the opening, is actually where I just every time he did something like that, I took away just volumes of this is the coolest thing. for me, anytime I watch a movie where they've integrated the opening, the logo, the studio logo, and it actually becomes a part of the film, I'm there.
All of the Indiana
the Indiana Jones films or Waterworld, where you see the polar ice caps melt on the Universal logo. Anytime you can do that, you've sold me. I don't care what you're doing in the rest of the film. You had me at hello. I'm ready to go. And when he did things like that, it worked. Now we've gone one step further. The sound the TARDIS makes, which is so distinctive and so much a part of it. We talked about the TARDIS being a character. It's there, and it's the parking brake's on. And it just destroyed 40 years of, you know, and it was great. It was so cool.
40 years of this is just the way the TARDIS sounds.
Yeah, and all of a sudden,
no. Here's why the TARDIS sounds
and
like
he,
that.
And he did it to us in Time Crash, too, which is another one you haven't got to yet, but we'll cover that one when we get to it. So just, and the fact that, again, coming from River, anybody else could have delivered that line and it wouldn't have worked.
Oh, no.
River's character and Alex King's portrayal of River is what totally sold that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there wasn't as much, not so much mystery to River this time, other than what's the deal with her and the bishop? I mean, that he has to keep an eye on her all the time. Oh, she was in prison. She killed someone that was a great man. which I'm kind of intrigued to find out who that is. I have heard from other podcasts that in Series 5, we don't find out who that is, and possibly in Series 6, we might, depending. It's still speculation.
The rumor mills are awash with possibilities. I've heard JFK.
I've heard that, too.
Which, interestingly enough, we're going to be set in 1960s Utah to start out the Series 1. So, yeah. Or Series 1. Series 6. So we see the 11th Doctor in the Oval Office at that point as well. So
I think that's probably where a lot of this is coming from. At one point she may kill the Doctor.
The first thing that popped into my mind when they alluded to that point that, you know, she killed somebody, and my first thought was, a great man, she kills the Doctor. And I think that and that goes back to my theory of how their timelines are starting at opposite ends, is that her redemption for what she did or what she's going to do or what she's done in her past, her redemption was to go back and save him at the beginning of their meeting. And I think that's a unique dynamic. Now, I don't know how you go about that without completely destroying Doctor Who and saying, okay, well, this is it. This is the last generation, because it almost cheapens the fact that she goes back to save him if it's not a finite death. If it's just a he dies and regenerates and moves on, then it just cheapens the redemption that she had going back and sacrificing her life for him. So, there's a lot of speculation. There's also the speculation that I totally don't buy into, that she is the Doctor in a future regeneration. I don't buy into that because I subscribe to the theory that on Gallifrey you've got Time Lords and Time Ladies. You've got, you know, male and female species that there's no reason to cross and, you know, generate, but that's out there as well, that perhaps because she knows how to fly the TARDIS, because he wasn't there the day that she flew the TARDIS, you know. And the other obvious interesting rumor out there is the fact that they were married at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which they very much tried to telegraph that in this episode.
Yeah, I think so,
too.
In these
two episodes, that they were married, or she is his, will be his wife, was his, her husband, or somehow it would fit in there properly.
If anybody could pull it off, Stephen Moffat. If the story arc is going to be that grandiose, and I don't think it would necessarily be something simple like a regeneration. I think it would have to be something fairly
ingenious and clever. Big. Yeah, no,
but I think he could pull it off. One other thing I wanted to comment on: the museum opening. Again, for me,
yeah,
just. What he's walking around. That's mine. That's one of mine. Ooh, I haven't seen that one.
That's wrong.
It was so Doctor. I mean, you've come to, and really.
Then they reference it later. That's how he keeps score.
Yeah.
Which I thought was funny.
I believe, and this is the interesting thing, if you go back and down and you watch linearly as they air, I believe, if I remember right, and feedback if I'm wrong here, but I believe this was the first two episodes they shot with Matt Smith. So this was him already, you know, four episodes in, but this was the first one they shot. And the interesting thing I find about that is, if I remember that right, and that's true, the energy is still there. You know, it seems like when you're experimenting with a character for the first time, and you don't quite know how you're going to play this character, how you're going to, you know, take an approach to a new character, Sylvester McCoy, I think, is a very good example of a Doctor who started on one episode and became a much different and better Doctor as he went along. As he kind of, you know, started to fit into the shoes of the Doctor, he kind of took his, you know, own approach to it and really, you know, made the Doctor his character. But to see Matt Smith, to hear that they shot this out of order like this, which they frequently do. I mean, they shoot episodes, you know, sporadically where they can.
Yeah.
And if this, in fact, was his first shooting, then to be able to then go back and then shoot something again like 11th hour later or something like that and still retain the same energy and not have this difference in the type of doctor we see in these two episodes is amazing and a testament to Matt Smith's acting.
I definitely think it's a testament to him. And maybe that goes back to something that I had commented on in my blog. It was that for the first time, I had a doctor that I didn't feel like I necessarily needed a warm-up. Every doctor is an adjustment. Every doctor is a little bit of a, I'm not sure how I feel about this guy yet, but I'm going to keep watching because I'm a fan of the show. And obviously we've heard horror stories of people that the new doctor comes along and they stop watching because, well, the show's over because right. so-and-so left. And it's like, I mean, we all felt the betrayal, but you got to move on because that's what the show's about. But Matt Smith, for whatever reason, I bought into it with 11th Hour. I was right there with him. And if that's true, maybe that has something to do with it because he didn't have to. There wasn't the adjustment period, you know, where he's growing into the character and, and becoming used to it. And Jonathan Frakes said something very interesting at the end of Next Gen. He, you know, lamented the fact that if only we could go back and reshoot the first season knowing what we know about these characters now. And I thought that was a really profound comment because when you're on a TV show and you're creating something for the first time, you don't know who this guy is. You're right. It's very, very daunting, I imagine, as an actor, especially as an actor coming into Doctor Who.
Well, something that's established, because it's one thing to come into Star Trek with brand new characters and, you know, an empty blank canvas, and you're going to paint this painting as you go along. But to come in with expectations, even though we've got a different type of doctor, we've got different mannerisms, we've got a different look, we've got all of that, you still have all of that history. You still have all of that warmth. And I agreed with your blog post from yesterday that, I felt the same thing. I didn't feel like we skipped a beat from David Tennant to Matt Smith. I felt like I already knew this guy.
Yeah.
That the setup was so well. And perhaps you're right. Maybe because this was, you know, shot out of order, Matt Smith was able to, you know, get a grasp of that character before we got introduced to him in 11th Hour. But then it goes back to the fact that I just don't feel like there's any difference in
these really
guys. Well, I think it is a tribute to Matt Smith's acting. And I think that is also why I see so many similarities. And when I went back and watched the Tenants after seeing Smith, that it felt like I was watching the same character on a completely different subject. After watching the Tenant episodes, I really like the new logo better. I don't know why, but I really like the fact that the D and the W are part of the TARDIS and the way that that all works. I like it's almost more creative than just the little whatever shape that is that says Dr.
Ovoid.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing is, and I remember when I first saw the logo for the first time in between, you know, the BBC clearly released the logo before the series came back. And I wasn't quite sure what I thought about it. I did like the DW forming the TARDIS, but it was just such a different look. And after getting used to and warming up to New Who for four, five seasons, well, technically four and, you know, four specials, you just got used to a certain look and a look to the opening of the show. And so then when season five comes along and suddenly we've got a different look to the Vortex, we've got a different, you know, the TARDIS is now being struck by lightning as it comes through, and we've got a new logo come swinging out at us. It was really an abrupt change to me, and it took me a little while to actually a few episodes to warm up to that open. But it's interesting that you say that looking at it out of order to you, it's
since I'm watching all of this out of order, I have a feeling. Well, since Matt Smith is the first Doctor I've watched,
your River Song,
my favorite.
You're going to start with the end of the Doctor's life, and we need to save Unearthly Child for the last episode.
Yeah. That's not going to happen.
No. I agree with you, though. When they first spoiled the logo, and boom, here's the new logo, I loved the DW concept with the light on top. That was like, oh, how come nobody did that before? That's cool. I wasn't sure how I felt about it being sandwiched between the Doctor Who words. I felt that was really unnecessary.
It's almost redundant.
Very much so. Especially when you see it in print.
Yeah.
You know, the cover of the DVD box, it's like, meh. But animating it on the opening screen and then rotating so that it's the TARDIS still, that made it work for me. That I was like, okay, yeah, you've made these two, what I thought were really disparaging elements, come together and work. I'm less certain about the Vortex. I didn't mind the lightning storm and the clouds and the TARDIS being struck because it's, you know, dramatic. And even the music has shifted just a little bit.
Which, fortunately, they haven't. It's while there's been a shift, it hasn't they didn't redo the theme. Yeah. I mean, there's still that iconic, you know, sound. Doctor Who theme has to be, even the 80 or 96 telemovie, you know, the music is just orchestrated. You know, it's the first time we got out of electronic music and really had a full backing of an orchestra, but you still hear that Doctor Who theme.
Yeah, it's
that's
still
always going to be there. But I didn't, even though there's a shift in the music, I think the best thing they did was keep Murray Gold on composing that, because what he did is he shifted it and made it feel new. It made it feel like, you know, a new season, a new series.
Well,
a new
there's
doctor.
Even a subtle shift in one of the David Tennant seasons. Toward the end, they switched it up, and it was a lot more drums.
Yeah.
And a lot more percussion elements to it, gearing up for that whole.
But not the arc. Change that we had here. But,
yeah,
but it's still attached enough to the old sound of the original, the opening from the first, you know, several series. So it still worked.
Now, having said that, and doing nothing but lavishing on praise for Stephen Moffat, the whole episode that we've done, I honestly believe that is going to tie into an episode at some point in time in the future. We've established that the Vortex looks like the opening of the show. Now we're going to, I hope, establish why it has changed. Why do we get storm clouds? Why do we get lightning strikes? Why is this different? And I don't know. This is just a theory of mine at this point. But I hope that Stephen Moffat, being the genius that I've built him up in my head, that he's planned all this out, and that at some point in time, however many, you know, seasons there are down the road, all of a sudden we're going to get something that's going to reveal this, and we're going to go, oh, are you kidding me?
Well, at the risk of deviating from our topics even more so than we were, I think we've already gotten a little taste of that, though, don't you think, with the crack? Now, let's not get too spoilery here, but with the way that the series gone and the crack has kind of been somewhat explained, and especially
we haven't talked about the crack,
especially
yet,
with the Big Bang finale, that almost was telegraphed by that opening to me. We're unstable now. The Vortex is, there's something wrong, something going on. And then, of course, the next year we're talking about the silence falling. So I almost think that's going to pay off for you, because I think that is a element there. But
Speaking of the crack, yeah. That makes what they did with that in this episode, the fact that it got broken wide open and that's how they dispatched all those angels.
I don't know that it broke wide open.
Well, it got bigger.
Well, I almost give it...
And the angels fed it to close it.
Yeah,
it was almost too convenient. In a way,
it was a little deus ex machina. It was a little bit of a, you know what we're going to do? We're going to dump the warp core and seal that breach. I really got that feel from it. I agree with you.
Yeah.
But
everything else besides that, I found really interesting. The fact that when he examined it, he said, oh, this is from an explosion or something at the end of the world, and we need to figure out where it originates, and then it somehow has to do with Amy, and they had to run off at the very last second of the episode because something was going to happen. I found all that really interesting and really made me excited to watch more.
What do you think of Amy?
I like her.
As a companion.
Yeah. She's fun, but she's a good balance to the Doctor. When the Doctor's being all serious, she's kind of lighter. And, like, in the episode when she's questioning River about what's your relationship to the Doctor. Are you guys married? And River turns to her and says, this is the Doctor we're talking about. You really think it's that simple? And she's like, yes, I do. She's like, oh, you're a good one. I like that character of her. That kind of.
Oh, River and Amy really had a great chemistry.
Yeah, they really did.
Now, going to have to refresh my memory, because this blurs together here. How did Flesh and Stone end? Did they go back to Amy's?
They go back to Amy's.
Okay. That's the scene where she
5 minutes
essentially
after.
Jumps him, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Well, just coming from a fresh set of eyes, because this was my only problem with the episode, and it makes sense, and I'm glad that the way that it worked out. But what did you think of that? The whole dynamic. I mean, they don't have this relationship like, and you won't know this, but the 10th Doctor and Rose starts developing a bit of romantic interest. Something I got a little tired of at one point. Now, there hasn't been this so far, and then suddenly she
jumps him. I think they hinted at it in the very first episode that she had this imaginary friend, and then she was so willing to run off with him that she built him up so much in her mind that she, this is this dream guy for me, and I'm going to meet him again one day. And honestly, I thought, well, what's your problem, doctor? She's hot. What are you doing?
Okay.
Seconded.
But it's like, okay. Then he says something about, I'm 907 years old. I don't die.
Yeah.
This can't work. And I, especially considering what Amy had just gone through, and that was the real first time she was truly in danger. Some people just respond to getting out of danger that way. So I kind of chalked it up to.
Okay. Cool. Because my problem is, and I thought I played it off so well, is that growing up with Doctor Who, the Doctor, I mean, clearly he's had perhaps a wife, perhaps, you know, he's clearly had kids. He had a granddaughter, you know. There obviously is some sort of romantic element to his life. One of the things that always set me aside was the relationship between Ten and Rose always seemed a bit too much, too close. But when they threw that at me, it was almost like it seemed too abrupt. And I understand what you're saying, where it was the element of danger and this is the man of her dreams type thing. But she's about to get married, and it's like I'm going to have this one last fling type thing it just felt like. Now, I don't know that she ran away. Yeah.
I don't think she wanted to marry.
Well,
of course.
We'll stop there because we still got a lot of season left.
Of course, granted, I know that she eventually does because of the Christmas Carol.
You have got to.
It seemed to me that it was something she didn't really want to do.
Yeah.
Like, she liked the guy, she didn't really have any other options.
I gotta leave it with that because that makes sense. Now, I do like the fact that the doctor says, whoa, wait a minute, no. You know,
I think that maybe that's what made that work for me was that Amy is very, she's a redhead. She's very fiery. She's very spunky. And she's very spur of the moment in a lot of things. You can see where the doctor's off thinking the ramifications through in some episodes, and she's just like, well, why don't we do this? And just kind of just impulsively acts on it. Very spontaneous. So that aspect of it immediately kind of like, okay, bam. And it's like, wow, okay. But then to watch Matt Smith's reaction to her,
was certainly priceless.
It goes forward not only with his acting, but the doctor character in general. He should be used to this by now. He should have. I mean, he's 900 some odd years old. Surely this has happened to him before. But Matt Smith manages to exhibit all of these moments where, despite all of his dealings with humanity, despite all of the things that he's learned in these 900 some odd years, he is such a moron when it comes to things like this. He's just lost.
And that's even more evident in A Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
When, you know, young Sadrach is asking him about, you know, what do I do here, you know, and he's like, I don't know, you know, or the comment of very young Cedric, where he says, well, let's talk about girls, you know, and it's just, you know, I think we're supposed to do that, you know, it's like he clearly does not know.
He just doesn't get it.
No information when it comes to that.
And throughout the episodes leading up to that point, they made reference at least once per episode of her running off with him. And making it sound kind of not dirty, but kind of dirty, and the fact that she ran off with him to be with him as opposed to the guy she's supposed to marry. That's just the impression I got from it. So that's why I didn't really
have much of an issue. That'll be interesting when we go on. Maybe we can revisit that.
Well, and that's something I think that any of us, and I can't speak for you being the newbie, Glenn and I, maybe not even you now that you've kind of got settled with family and kids and everything like that. I'm still at that point, if that blue box ever materialized in front of me, I'm gone. If I get the opportunity, I apologize now to family and friends, I'm gone. You will not hear from me again, and I won't regret it. And maybe that's different. Spielberg commented at the end of Close Encounters that today he could never make Close Encounters because he could never do a movie where the guy leaves his wife and family. Yeah, I don't know if you... Just to step outside the fantasy for a moment.
It's interesting that you bring that up. I never thought about it before. But I do take a different perspective to it, because I think I live intravenously through the companions that get that opportunity, yeah. to which you do as well. But if that blue box materialized, I'm not sure that at a point in my life that I could run off and do that. And that is interesting that you asked that, because it never really occurred to me.
I think maybe that's why it works for Amy, is because she's right on that cusp where she hasn't crossed over.
Well, and she also mentions, well, this is a time machine, right? You can bring me back by morning. Right, right. Well, then, yeah, let's go.
She makes that point that she's got a date that she has to be back for. And they... A lot of trust in that. But.
Which is interesting that they've kind of... Eccleston always had that... They kind of established that time was still moving forward.
Well, I think time is still moving forward for the Doctor.
Yeah.
The Doctor, his timeline has always been linear. I mean,
that's true.
With the exception of revisiting himself, you know, the three doctors, five doctors, two doctors,
and time
the story revolves around his linear timeline. Yeah, so and time crash. Yeah,
which in these four episodes or even five episodes really hammer that home, that I truly get that now, where his timeline is going forward and he's jumping through other timelines and jumping around in different points, but his is linear. Mm-hmm. That these, especially the stuff with River, really sends that home, that you get that point.
Absolutely.
From a time travel aspect, because I know you're a huge time travel fan. Has the show really worked for you in that regard?
It's worked for me really well so far.
I mean, because it's not your typical...
It's not your normal time travel, and we haven't...
It's not Back to the Future. We're not doing paradoxes, and
Haven't had the issue that we did in Christmas Carol.
That's true.
Well, in most time travel movies, time is almost the antagonist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas in Doctor Who, time always seems to be the hero, or the... At least not... You're not against time as often as you are in a time travel film or a time travel story. Time is on your side a lot of times in Doctor Who. I mean, we still have deadlines. We still have things that are going to happen, and you can't just use time to, pop back and fix it. Well, clearly you can with a Christmas Carol, but
as long as it's not a time lock.
But it's
event,
not as much of
okay.
an antagonist in Doctor Who.
They keep saying that
Who.
Time can be rewritten.
And they
I'm curious to learn about that.
They
more.
Do. I'll be interested to go back and pick up the specials with you, because. That the dynamic between those changes a lot. So. Hmm. But anyway,
but the crack stuff got me really excited to watch the next few episodes. So, for next week, I'll do three more episodes, or
that sounds good.
Maybe four.
We've got Vampires of Venice. don't spoil it for him. Amy's Choice.
Yay!
And then a two-parter: Hungry Earth and Cold Blood.
Well, then we'll be doing four episodes.
Okay.
I won't be able to stop on a cliffhanger.
We can do that. That's good. Something I'd also mentioned, and this might be just something that we discuss, after the show, but maybe we'll talk about it here, is I had also maybe entertained the idea of doing, when we hit classic monsters, maybe we ought to do two, because this might be the way to do this.
Oh.
When we hit classic monsters, maybe we ought to have two for next week, and then... We know of at least three Solarian stories from the classic Who. I wonder if it maybe would be interesting to go back and maybe even have him watch the present day episodes and then go back and get a little bit of the history of the Suntarans, obviously, or not Suntarans,
not Suntarans.
Solarians. As we get to that, that might be interesting to go back and so that we see a broader picture of their origins and their lore. So maybe that's something
we could
to discuss.
Do a whole Solarian episode.
And give us,
it would be interesting to, because I'd like to revisit some of those. I haven't seen Sea Devils in a long time.
Yeah, it's been
Warriors
years,
of the Deep.
So.
Which Warriors of the Deep will be kind of painful to go back and watch, but it's not a good, very good episode. But anyway, but
well,
we
let
can
us
certainly
know,
decide.
If you have an opinion on that.
There we go. We'll
that.
Put it out to the viewers again. Yeah. The listeners again.
And you can find that poll on our website, which is
travelingthevortex.blogspot.com.
Or you can send an email to travelingthevortex@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on Facebook at Traveling the Vortex.
Or on Twitter.
Or Travel. Is it just Travel Vortex?
No, Travel Vortex.
No, on Facebook.
Oh, it's Twitter. Yes, I'm sorry.
On Facebook. It's, yes. Don't confuse me.
You're confused enough.
I am not good with this. Although, I don't have my phone with me, so I can't give a specific shout out. I have a stalker on Twitter. Is that what they're called? Followers?
Follower.
I have a follower.
You start calling them stalkers, they might unfollow you.
Yeah, I'm at the point in my life I could use a couple stalkers, too. But I have a follower on Twitter, so whoever you are, thank you. That's just cool to me. Can we talk about the security breach?
No, let's not.
Okay. I thought that was cool that we made it to the point where somebody felt it necessary to break in. It's like, people are listening to us.
I think perhaps that was so they could just spam us, but that's...
I was, fan mail.
Best feedback we've gotten.
Look at that. I got coupons for Viagra. Definitely let us know whether or not you think Keith should, and we'd probably put a little bit shorter of a window on the
poll.
Thank you. We can, because we're going to have to figure out a time to actually record these, but, you know. And sit down and watch if we're going to do that as a group.
We need to do that sometime.
Mr. Family Man. With your obligations.
Absolutely.
No joining the TARDIS crew for you. We love you, Holly. We're just kidding.
I think that pretty much wraps up this episode then. Do you guys want to add anything that we haven't talked about?
Bow ties are cool.
Bow ties are cool.
I'm convinced. I'm ready. I'm going to convert over. And I'm starting Tuesday. I go back for the semester at Washburn University. I don't know if anybody knows that. I'm going back to school after a long time. And Dr. Farley, the president of the university, wears bow ties.
Mm-hmm.
Always worn bow ties. And I just, to have that all of a sudden, that connection that he's there. And then
sometimes the tweed patch.
And he's very, 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 very old school. And then all of a sudden to have Dr. Who on wearing all this stuff has made me look at Dr. Farley in a new light and go, yeah, he's had it all along. Bow ties are cool. So shout out to Dr. Farley.
That's right.
Well, and definitely check the show notes. Our Google Voice line is there, too.
Yeah. One of these days, we'll have the Google Voice number for you to be able to tell you that on air. But check the show notes. We'll have that in there as well. All right. Well, that's going to do it for us then. For myself, Sean, and Keith, cheers.
Have a good one.
Be seeing you.
You have been listening to Traveling the Vortex. Doctor Who and all of its associated programs are owned and trademarked by the BBC. No infringement is intended or implied.